Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is episode 16 of The Josh Marshall Show. Today, we are speaking to historian Timothy Snyder. You've probably seen his name in the news recently. He has a new book out about authoritarianism that is not explicitly or all about President Trump, but gets into a lot of issues surrounding him, and that has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple months. He is also, more broadly, a historian of Central and Eastern Europe. And another book you may be familiar with is Bloodlands, a book that came out a few years ago. What we're going to talk about today is a book that I think is a little less known because it was published almost 15 years ago. It's called The Reconstruction of Nations, and it goes back, it comes up as recently as the 1990s, but it goes back about four centuries, and it has to do with the history of what we now know as Poland, Belarus, Ukraine, and Lithuania, and how you have, over these three or four centuries, very different understandings about what nations are, what states are, and how you organize groups of people politically. Each of these states today are broadly ethnically homogeneous states. The vast majority of people who live in Poland are ethnic Poles, define themselves as such. A little less so in Ukraine, but largely so. But that was not always the case. You have different histories, different periods when states weren't arranged by what we now think of as national or ethnic consciousness at all. And that's what this book is about. I will tell you, I read lots and lots of history. This is one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time. And even coming to it with a decent amount of knowledge of this area and the history, I learned a tremendous amount from it, not just about the history, but about history itself and about different the evolution of nationalism, and particularly, and this is what one of the things we get into in this conversation, which we're about to have, is how this history, what it tells us about the present moment. What is nationalism? What are toxic and relatively non-toxic forms of nationalism? What is the EU? What is its role? What is Europe? And what is the U.S., what is the United States' relationship to Europe? These are all very important today, and this is a history that helped me understand it in a new way. For many of you, you may remember a post that I wrote the middle of last year, or sometime last summer. The title was something to the effect of, "This is not the natural order of things." And what I was getting at in that post was, we, and when I say we, I mean people, adults living today in the U.S., imagine that the world that we live in and the one that we have inherited is, in some sense, the natural order of things. We, and in this sense, I mean we by people in the United States and most of the people in Western Europe, have come off a period of 60 or 70 years of what is, by historical standards, great wealth and very uncommon stretch of peace. Now, not everybody is equal. There are people who are very poor, people who are very rich. There are people who have racial privilege, and there are people who do not. But compared to what preceded our era, we have great prosperity and a level of peace that I think it is hard for us to understand is not the way that things have to be. In fact, judged against the backdrop of history, it's not common at all. And what I was trying to convey in that post was that this is not the natural order of things. Things can be vastly more violent. The prosperity we live in is not natural. And it came to exist because of what a lot of people did at various points in the last 100 years, and a lot of people who died to make all of this possible, or who died to set the stage for it. So what I talk about, that is the backdrop of what made me so interested in this book, because it gets into that kind of deeper history of this part of Europe, but also more broadly about Europe in general and about Europe in the United States, and what the history, what our history is about, how the world we live in could be very different, and how we need to remember that to not only make the world we live in a better one, but not slip back into the very dark past that existed as recently as 70 or 80 years ago. So, with all of that, let's talk to Timothy Snyder, a professor of history at Yale University and the author of The Reconstruction of Nations. Hi, Tim.
Hey.
So, you are very well known for a series of books. You have a new book out called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. That's about a very contemporary topic. Many know you for the book Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, which is about the period of almost unprecedented bloodletting in the middle of the 20th century, in this area of borderlands between Germany and Russia. But what I wanted to at least start our conversation with about today is a book that you wrote in 2003 called The Reconstruction of Nations, which is about the evolution or transformation of different kinds of nationalisms, different ideas of what states are in this, in broadly speaking, this same part of Europe, what we now call Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, Lithuania, the Baltic states, part of the Baltic states. So can you tell us what the story is? I mean, one, let me just start it. One part that that keyed in is absolutely fascinating to me about this book, which I knew a little about, but I just did not know the backstory, is today we know Vilnius is the capital of Lithuania, and we take it as given that the capital of a nation state is populated by people of that nationality. And yet, until quite recently, until the middle of the 20th century, Vilnius, for many of its inhabitants, had a different name, and it had very few Lithuanian speakers. So can you explain that for us as a way for kind of getting into this broader story?
Yeah, I mean, it's Vilnius is a really good example of the broadest problem of history and memory, and also a really good example of the difference between early modern and modern history, which is really the subject of Reconstruction of Nations. So bad history, which often goes under the name of memory, tells us why things always had to be the way they are now. So if you look at Vilnius today, the capital, as you say, of an independent Lithuanian state, today populated in its tremendous majority by speakers of Lithuanian, bad history will explain to you why it always had to be that way. And it will look for every indication in the past that there was a trend towards this outcome. What good history does is it explains what was possible and what wasn't possible, what was likely and what was less likely, and leaves some room for agency and for accident. Early modern and modern history, the difference between the one and the other is really the subject of Reconstruction of Nations. Because in Europe, and to a certain extent all around the world, the big political transformation, you know, circa, you know, the end of the 18th century to the middle of the 20th century, the big political transformation has to do with how you get from realms where there's a monarch and where there are multiple religions and multiple languages and multiple identities, how do you get from that to states where there's a single set of authorities and usually a single language and quite possibly a single national identity? And without saying that one is good and the other is bad, we are looking at a general trend. So the city of Vilnius helps us a lot here, because if we look at Vilnius, as you say, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, you could say, well, that's a Jewish city, or that's a Polish city, or you could say in territory, it's on the territory of today's Belarus, or you could say it was the capital of something called the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and therefore it's Lithuanian, or you could even say it's part of the traditional East Slavic world, and therefore it's Russian. You could say all kinds of things, and all of them would be true in a certain way, but all of them would be basically false, because in that early modern world, there was no natural overlap between nation, state, language, religion, and so on. In that early modern world, governance was about getting soldiers and tax money from hugely heterogeneous populations and territories. And what does this all mean for the nation? What it means for the nation is that nations lie about themselves. They have to. What nations say is that we were always here and we always were like we are today. That's a lie. That's not true. The only way for a nation to come into being is for the nation to overcome this tradition of variety, which you have pretty much everywhere in Europe. So, I mean, to kind of come to an end of this, the only way for Vilnius to be the capital of Lithuania and for Vilnius to be a homogeneous Lithuanian-speaking city is for people to overcome a history of variety. That's the basic subject of the reconstruction of nations, how you get from the early modern to the modern by overcoming, by undoing variety, both mentally and demographically, and how once you've done it, you forget that you've done it, and you say that things were always the way they are today.
So one thing in this, I mean, another kind of fascinating thing for me is, I guess it's Josef, not Joseph, but Pilsudski, who is one of the sort founding fathers of modern Poland, as you say in the book, actually thought of himself as a Polish Lithuanian, which in our kind of modern way of thinking about things seems like an oxymoron. The one key thing about the book is you do have the evolution of national ideas and national identity. But to get where you are today, where you have relatively linguistically, ethnically homogeneous states in Ukraine, Poland, so on and so forth, you go through this period of you know, borderline, in a lot of cases, borderline genocidal activity in the areas where things overlap. You couldn't, you know, you can say it's things are somewhat stable and rationalized now, but only at the expense of unimaginable bloodletting in, to some extent, in the aftermath of World War One, but especially in the late 1930s and through the 1940s. Can you give us a sense, how does that affect Poland and Ukraine, just to start with, setting aside Lithuania for the moment?
Well, one of the interesting things about the construction of modern nations is that there's always disagreement about what the modern nation should look like. Whether you're looking at the history of Poland or the history of Ukraine, sure, we can say now, we can focus now on the people who wanted those places to be ethnically homogeneous. But they were always in an argument with other people who said, no, there's a history of toleration in these territories, and the future is not about homogeneity. The future has to be about some kind of about handling variety. And it's interesting that you mentioned Poland and Ukraine, because and Józef Pilsudski in particular, because Pilsudski, who was the most important politician in Poland in the 20s and 30s, was not somebody who wanted Poland to be homogeneous. On the contrary, he was internally heterogeneous himself. He cursed in Russian. You know, he could speak the Belarusian of the peasants who around where he grew up. He regarded himself as a Lithuanian in a historical sense, even though he was a Polish revolutionary and then a Polish statesman. And if one looks at contemporary Ukraine, we're in much the same situation. I mean, there are, of course, Ukrainian nationalists, and there are a few Russian-speaking nationalists at the other end of the country in the east. But the broad consensus would be something like, you have to be able to manage variety. You have to have, you know, you have to be able to handle the fact that most people speak both Ukrainian and Russian in a contemporary Ukrainian state. You can't imagine that variety away. So people can think that, and people can also think, no, the only way to have a state is for there to be ethnic homogeneity. We have to drive out variety, and we have to create a unitary state. I'm trying to say that that was always a discussion, and that discussion is going on today, and it will probably continue indefinitely. In the case of Poland and Ukraine, you have massive, you have mass murder, and you have what we now call genocide or ethnic cleansing in the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s. Not so much as a result of internal nationalism, although that matters, but more as a result of external policies. So the Holocaust, in which, of course, Poles and Ukrainians and others take part, is nevertheless a Nazi policy, and that removes one of the most important elements of those societies, the millions of Jews who were killed on the territory of Poland and Ukraine. Then you have Soviet policies, which also tend to discriminate against particular groups, especially Poles in 37 and 38 in the Soviet Union. And then after the Second World War, Soviet power tends to push against their will, Poles in one direction, Ukrainians in another direction, leading to ethnic homogeneity, at least in Western Ukraine and in much of Poland. What I find interesting about all of that is that it's not so much the nationalism that created the homogeneity. The causal arrow can also go the other way. That is, if you have the experience of being ethnically cleansed on the basis of your nation, you tend to end up believing that your nation is a very important part of your identity, partly because of what's happened to you, but also partly because once you're stripped from your actual homeland and put somewhere else, the only thing you have in common with the people you end up among is maybe nation, religion. You don't have any local commonalities because you're from somewhere else. So the process of ethnic cleansing can actually create that kind of national identity rather than being simply a result of it. Now, what does this all mean for Poles and Ukrainians today? It means that there are a lot of unresolved questions about who's responsible for the ethnic cleansing, which in my view, it's never a simple answer. It's not that the Poles or the Ukrainians are responsible, because there are always other historical forces in play. But there is the opportunity for taking historical responsibility, which is the positive way of seeing all of this. And then for Poles and Ukrainians and for everyone in Europe, there's a larger question of once you have the state, you realize, okay, whether the state is nationally homogeneous or not, it turns out that having a state is not the end of history, that you have to look for some kind of larger entity. And that entity in this context is usually something like the European Union.
Now, one thing in the reconstruction of nations, and I think it's fair to say that even though it is about a number of different nationalities, Poland, Polish speakers are kind of a fulcrum around which the book revolves in some ways, and one of the many interesting things about the book, and this comes towards the end, and I would really recommend it to readers for this among other reasons, is that during the period of Soviet domination of Poland, and for our listeners to understand, the Polish state that existed in the 1920s and 1930s is very different from the Polish state after World War II and that we have now. Basically moved to the west. It lost a lot of territory in the east, and it gained a lot of what had been German territory in the west. And during the late Soviet period, there was a lot of thinking that went into what a free Poland would be like and how not to have to violently revisit that land should still be ours, and you think this, you know, all that kind of stuff. Can you walk us through that part of the history?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because whether or not a new state is going to succeed, or whether reform in a new state is going to succeed, tends to have a lot to do with how much got thought out ahead of time. And that's the kind of thing which political scientists or other analysts might not notice, but historians would have a chance of noticing. And as you quite rightly say, Poland was special in the communist world because, especially after Solidarity, there was a certain amount of civic space, both within communist Poland and among the numerous and often really intelligent and interesting emigres, to think about what kind of Poland there should be. So there was a discussion in the 70s, 1970s and 1980s, again to emphasize, while Poland was still communist, about how Poland should rearrange its relations were it to become free. And the consensus that emerged from a rethinking of the 20th century was that Poland needs to make sure that it doesn't contest territories, borders with Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine, with its eastern, with its future eastern neighbors, because at the time these are all, those are all still Soviet republics. But the idea is, if Poland is going to be, is going to maintain its independence in the future, once it is fortunate enough to have independence, the first thing it has to do is to recognize Belarus, Lithuania, and Ukraine as being like it, as opposed to being its past colonies or somehow inferior, to recognize those places as also being states. Not so much in the name of fairness or justice, although that comes into the conversation, but in the interest of maintaining the Polish state, on the logic that the principle of recognizing borders and moving forward towards Europe within states is in the Polish interest, on the logic that if Poland questions, say, a Lithuanian or Ukrainian border, Germans could very logically do the same thing to Poland, because after all, Poland moves west, that means it loses territory on its east, but it means it's gained territory from Germany on its west. So there's a rethinking of history and a certain kind of a thoughtful realism that emerged. And in the early 1990s, and this is where Reconstruction of Nations really ends, that thinking became foreign policy, and you had this extraordinary moment where Poland, in effect, recognized its eastern neighbors before they even existed, mm-hmm. In order to make sure that there wouldn't be those kinds of issues.
And this is one of the fascinating things, because it is, for those of us who were alive in the 70s and 80s, that it didn't necessarily, it seemed like the East-West U.S.-Soviet confrontation would go on forever. And the idea that Eastern Europe would regain full sovereignty took some imagination. But as you kind of get out in the book, the idea that the Soviet Union would actually collapse and these states would become independent, that turned out to be true, but didn't really make a great deal of sense. At least I wouldn't have thought so in the 1970s or 1980s. So there's this sort of historical imagination that and a lot of this centers around this emigre publication, I guess published in France, a lot of imagination that turned out to be right, but didn't even really make a great deal of sense.
I mean, it all has to do with when you come into international relations and when you encounter the Soviet Union. So the United States enters the world in earnest with the Second World War, mm-hmm. and with the Cold War. And so when we enter, the Soviet Union is already there. And the Soviet Union is a great power. And as we know perfectly well at the time, even if we forget it later, it's the Soviet Union that really defeats Nazi Germany. And the Soviet Union then establishes these replicate states in Eastern Europe. So for Americans who were looking out into the world for the first time, maybe learning Russian as their first foreign language, the Soviet Union is just there. It's a monolith. It's part of the structure. I mean, it might as well be a mountain range. It's just there. Mm-hmm. But for the people we're talking about, the Poles we're talking about, the people who established that that immigrant publication in around Paris, which was called Kultura, they saw the Soviet Union differently. They were from Poland. They were Russian speakers. They were around. They had, many of them, been expelled from towns or cities that became Soviet. They had taken part in the Polish-Bolshevik War in 1919 to 1920, which Poland actually won. They had been, some of them had been intelligence operatives that had worked on Soviet territory in 1920 and 1930. The point is not that Poland came out on top in that confrontation with the Soviet Union. It didn't, of course. The Soviet Union invades Poland in 1939 along with Germany, and Poland comes to an end. The point, though, is that the Soviet Union for them was not a monolith. It was a historical creation with strengths and with weaknesses, which they had experienced at its high points and at its low points. So for them, although they respected, they respected Russia and Ukraine, they had a slightly longer term point of view. They had seen the Soviet Union come, and so it was natural to imagine that it might go. They mm-hmm. didn't know when, but it wasn't so strange for them to imagine that it could go.
Right. It's funny. This, early in your book, you and I think it may be even in the premise, you have a part where you explain and apologize isn't the right word, but explain, anticipating, I think, potential criticism, that the history of Zionism is not part of this book about competing nationalisms in this area, even though what had been the Jewish population is obviously a key part of it. And I think you explain that, and it makes sense that Zionism takes place somewhere else, and it is just it's hard to cover it in the same book, even though obviously Jews are a major part of the book. And I will say that I have read a great deal about the history of Zionism and have my own personal political commitments tied to Zionism, but I never understood it in the same way until I read this book. And just for our listeners, it is this sort of, it's this for me at least, reading this book, it is this implicit reality that is always kind of hanging in the background, because one of the idea of state creation is an obvious part of that, but coming out of this history, this the last 120 years, the need for the perceived need for ethnic populations to somewhere control a state to be safe is a constant theme. And as you say, that is not a reality that exists outside of history. That's a reality that took on a certain sense as people were being ethnically cleansed and killed in millions over a period. I mean, what is now Vilnius was once called, the Jerusalem of the North, because it was such a major city in the history of Ashkenazic Judaism. And when you write about Vilnius, I can't help but think of Jerusalem, which Zionists think of as an inherently Jewish city, but one which, Hebrew was all but not spoken a century ago, and was a Muslim city, was an Arab Muslim city, even though Zionists will point out, of course, that there's always been some Jewish population there. So there's just an analogy there, and I will just say, even though it doesn't directly connect with other parts of what I want to talk about, even though it is not a focus of the book, again, it helped me understand Zionism in a deeper way. But let's come back to another point, because you mentioned, as Poland, as these other states emerged out of the collapse of Soviet dominance in Eastern Europe, and then the collapse of the Soviet Union itself, you did have relatively linguistically homogenous states that came into being, but Poland entered the European Union and NATO. But the idea of Europe was a central one for how the people who created this new Poland understood what Poland would be and how it would interact with its eastern neighbors. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, there are a couple of things going on there. One is very profound, and one is much more practical. The profundity is the realization, which is a mature realization, I think a correct one, that even if in some future the Soviet Union breaks down and countries become sovereign, sovereignty isn't enough. And that's a lesson which comes out of the 1920s and 1930s, when Poland was, of course, a sovereign state, but it lasted for less than two decades, and had that in common with a number of other East European states. So the notion being that you imagine a return to Europe, but the paradox is that you're not going back to the 1930s, you're going to a much better Europe, one that has institutions. And that's the practical part. What Polish diplomats and intellectuals did in the late 80s and early 90s was to tell Europe what it was. Europe is a place which is bound by rules. Europe is a place which is open to new members. And this was partly persuading oneself, and it was also partly persuading European leaders, who in the early 90s actually had no interest in expanding the European Union at all. So it was a spiritual project, but it was also a technical project. The nation has to land somewhere, and that place where it lands is going to supply the rules. And the rules are very simple things like nobody gets to change borders.
Right. So how... As everybody knows now, you had this. I guess we'll know 20 and 30 years from now how historically contingent the UK leaving the EU was, how random that was. But the whole EU project is under profound strain. A big part of that has to do with how it was bound together economically, and how the 2008 financial crisis affected it. You obviously have this. This refugee crisis that is in part being driven by the Syrian civil war. You have a revanchist Russia that is trying to reassert itself. All of these things are happening right now. And your book on tyranny, authoritarianism, gets at some of these issues. How does the history that we are talking about, how should it inform this crisis that we are, that we as Americans, as we as members of NATO, as whatever community we choose to express ourselves in, that we are in the midst of? How does that history illuminate what we are facing today?
Well, let me make a couple points about that. The first would be, I mean, from an American point of view, a reminder that most of the things that we take for granted in our own inheritance, whether it's being a democracy where everyone more or less has the right to vote, whether it's the great prosperity that we have largely, although not all of us, have enjoyed in the last three generations, whether it's our sense of power or being at the center of things, all of those things happened while we were closely bound to Europe. Those are all, we don't know what the U.S. would have been like without the transatlantic relationship, but we do know that the transatlantic relationship coincided with all of those things. And this can be specified in, you know, in less misty language. Europe as it stands now is the biggest economy, not only in the world, but in the history of the world. So even for those of us who tend to think purely in economic or trade terms, there's an entity there which matters very heavily for us. The second thing, the point that I would make about this, has to do about what it takes for nations and states to survive, which of course is a big subject of the reconstruction of nations. And you're very kind to bring it up now because it's a project which is a couple of decades old. But at the center of it is this powerful tragedy, really, that no matter how much you struggle for independence, you can't really get it on your own. You need something else to help you out. And that's not just a lesson for Lithuanians, Poles, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. It's actually the main theme of all of European history in the 20th century. There is really no moment in Europe where nation states made it. Either you were a small nation state and you got crushed in the 1930s, or you were an empire and you lost your empire in the 40s, 50s, or 60s, with a few exceptions, like, say, Finland. That those two categories capture basically everyone. And what this means is that the whole way that Europeans and Americans talk about the European Union is actually a kind of mysticism. We imagine that the European Union is made up of a bunch of nation states that went in and therefore can go out. But it's just not true. There never really was a moment when there was a French nation state or a British nation state. There was a moment when there was a Polish nation state, but it was destroyed. So the real lesson of the European Union is that you need some kind of larger entity. It doesn't have to be today's EU. It could be something else. But you need some kind of larger entity to keep the state going. Right. And so the thing that people don't realize when they vote for Brexit or if they vote for Marine Le Pen in France is that if you vote against the EU, you're not voting for your nation. You're voting against your nation, because your nation has never actually shown that it can survive without this larger entity around it. And the third point, you know, which one, something you already stressed, is that we've never really seen what it's like for the European Union to face an enemy, which it now does in the form of Russia. The Russian invasion of Ukraine was a violation of the very rule that Poles were so obsessed about in the 1990s, and understandably so, the rule that territory doesn't change. We're not going to change boundaries. Whatever happens is going to happen inside boundaries in order to help us to cooperate better through boundaries, but boundaries themselves are not going to change. When Russia invades Ukraine in 2014, it's breaking a very important rule, and that is unfortunately just the opening act in a much larger campaign to help dissolve the European Union and to dissolve transatlantic ties.
So to come at your point, and I mean, just to make explicit what you're saying, I mean, there's, for our readers, there's a post that I wrote sometime in the middle of last year, or something. The title was something to the effect of, like, you know, this isn't the natural state of being. And I do think, because we have certainly Western Europe and the United States has come off a period of 60 or 70 years where, in global historical terms, we are very wealthy. There has not been a cataclysmic war. There's been small regional wars, but there's been general peace. And so there is a great temptation to think that's just how the world works. And in fact, that's not how the world works at all. That this, at various points, you can point to people who went to great lengths and sacrificed a lot and worked very hard to create what now seems natural to us. And certainly during last year's presidential election, what we see happening now in Turkey, the sort of seemingly very casual British exit from the European Union, just in a kind of a, again, seemingly very historically accidental way, although I'm sure we'll think later, we'll see the roots of it later. Tell us, obviously, it's hard to know what Trump actually thinks, since he seems to be moving away from some of the radical nationalism that he espoused during the campaign. You see that in foreign policy terms. The issue of Russia and Russian revanchism is obviously very very present in U.S. politics right now, because there's a question of how was Trump tied to Russia and hacking and so on and so forth. Let's talk a little more broadly, though. What do you see Russia as trying to achieve in the broadest sense in what it calls its near abroad, in these sort of now neighboring states? How should we understand what Russia is now trying to do, what Vladimir Putin is trying to do? What is his project?
Well, let me make it even a step more broad than that, because I don't want to get caught too much in the politics of today, mm-hmm. and even in tensions of Mr. Putin, important though he is. I think it might be more useful still to think about Russia as an alternative, as a project. You know, we have a tendency to think, the Obama administration had a tendency to say, well, Russia is just a regional power, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And others of us had a tendency to say, well, Russia is just a kind of failed transition. It didn't manage to become a democracy. Too bad for them. I think those are the wrong ways of looking at it. I think Russia should be seen as an alternative system which functions according to its own logic, based mainly upon natural resource wealth, organized into a kind of kleptocracy with very good secret services, which has correctly understood that, at least under the current regime, it's reached limits on wealth and reached limits on freedom, and that rather than try to become more like the European Union or like the United States, what Mr. Putin has understood is that one can accept these limits, one can keep the nation unfree and poor, but try to bring everyone else down to Russia's level. So what Russia practices is a kind of strategic relativism, where rather than trying to move up towards Europe or towards the West, it's trying to move Europe and the West down towards it. And the weapons in all of this are things which flow very naturally from Russian domestic governance. The fake news is probably the most important. Russia persuades its own people that nothing is true, that you can't trust anyone, that the rule of law is a joke, democracy is a joke. And if you think everything is a joke, then obviously you're not going to be resisting. And then that can get exported. And you see that it's exported. The idea that everything's a conspiracy, everything's a sham, nothing's really true, there are no authorities, can't trust the journalists. Those ideas, of course, have other roots, but those are ideas that Russia exports to the West, exports to us, in the attempt to make us more like them. And the point I'm trying to say is that this is plausible. You know, this can happen. The election of Mr. Trump is a big step in this direction. And regardless of, the day-to-day, are they getting along? Did we just bomb Syria? I think the real question is, do we like that model, or do we prefer a different model? Because the model of Russia, this mixture of resource wealth plus kleptocracy plus, just enough far-right nationalism to get by, we can see the outlines of that. In our White House, we don't really have a democratic camp, but we do have a kleptocratic camp, and we do have a nationalist camp. And those are the same camps that Russia has. So we're drifting in that direction. I think that the important thing is to see Russia as a kind of plausible alternative, which has its own sort of power, and to decide whether that's really what we want.
So as the potential leader of a global kind of illiberal state movement? I mean, this is the part that I sort of struggle with. I mean, on the one hand, they are having limited success as being sort of the leader of global sort of right illiberal states, for lack of a better word. On the other hand, Russia is, you're right, to call it a regional power is sort of weird given all the history, but it is in many ways an impoverished a state that is struggled on various fronts, and this is making mischief to keep what it sees as its potential enemies off balance, to
Absolutely.
Sort of screw up the EU, sort of put a kind of a I'm not sure you could say put a clown in charge of the US, but help one gain power. I'm sure it's both, but can you sort of tease those two apart with
I think the one relates very closely to the other. What Russia has managed to do is to use the weapons of the weak. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of foreign trade, they're about as important as the Netherlands. In terms of GDP, they're about as important as France. According to, you know, even their military, which is the most impressive thing about them, is not actually that large. If Europe decided to, it could field a much larger one in a few years. So they're not powerful according to traditional indices of power. And what they've managed to do is to marshal the weapons of the weak. So the whole idea of fake news, that's basically costless. It costs almost nothing to do that. You know, RT, they're one of their, you know, propaganda broadcasters, the most important, costs a few hundred million dollars a year. That's nothing. You know, that's the cost of one missile strike. That's nothing. Mm-hmm. The employing 1,000 trolls in St. Petersburg to transmit targeted bursts of fake news to the right electorate in certain red states or purple states, that probably cost them $1 million, let's say. It's extremely cheap, but there's a huge payoff. I mean, given that, you know, Mr. Trump won by a few thousand votes scattered over four states, and that those states were the ones that were precisely targeted by the Russians, you can see that it's very cheap, and yet you can have a world historical payoff from it. So I think what you're saying is absolutely right. It's just that they understand that. They know their limitations.
Right.
They're exploiting the things that they can exploit. And in a way, they're wrong-footing us, because if you look back to 2016, how many of us understood how important the internet and fake news were going to be? We didn't understand that, but the Russians had some kind of an idea.
Right. Now, I guess it seems to me, the other part of this is that obviously there are things happening in a healthier politics in the United States would have been less vulnerable to this kind of external interference. And clearly, that project, that if we go back to the beginning of our conversation that the polls played a key role in beginning in the 1990s about a, you know, creating that idea of was it European standards, I guess, is, I'm sure, a different word in some phrase in Polish. That is under great stress. And we see that in France, there was something happening in the UK, and there's a very different situation in Hungary and so forth. The Russians are clearly taking advantage of these stresses. But what are the stresses? How should we understand them, and understanding them, think about ways to address them here and in Europe?
Yeah, okay, I see your strategy. You keep asking me harder questions as this goes on.
Don't worry, we're almost done. I'll have mercy.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, as a historian, I'll start with the question of time. One thing that's happened is just generational, that it's not just the generation who has experienced the Second World War has passed. It's that the generation of the children of the Second World War, you know, the young people who had some notion of how much that mattered, you know, the generation of Helmut Kohl, for example, or even of George Bush the First, that generation has also passed, not necessarily from life, but from power. And so, therefore, you know, we in the third, fourth, fifth generations out can very easily take things for granted, as you said earlier, which are in fact highly, highly fragile and subject to pretty rapid disintegration if we don't attend to them. So there's that, you know, which means that. And this is sort of my whole career right now. I mean, which means that you have to fight for historical awareness before you realize what the future can look like. I think the second thing which is happening, which one has to be aware of, is inequality. That, especially within the U.S., it's very hard to make a case for standards of any kind, for participation in a world economy, for a transatlantic relationship, to people who see, and they're right, that that their children are not going to have the same kind of shot at life that they did. I mean, all in all, GDP per capita and so on is going up. I know that. But the places which voted for Trump are very often places where there is extreme local inequality. And, you know, the fact that since 1989, since the end of communism, that the general trend has been for wealth to be more and more concentrated in the United States makes universal politics of any kind, whether it's national, international, much, much harder. At the European level, something which has happened is that they haven't thought their way through to the balance between the state and the European level. You know, people who are critical of the European Union are right that it's not as democratic as it could be. Finding that balance where you maintain national symbols and national culture, where while you have a larger level of governance, is very hard. I tend to think that it could be done. I actually tend to think that it will be done. But that's the problem that has to be solved. Because places like Spain, Portugal, Greece, and even in my view France and Germany are not going to make it as the kinds of countries they are now without that larger level of trade, movement of labor, and so on. But how you handle the politics of that has to be thought through. You know, the mistake they made, a little bit like what we did, is to imagine that progress after 1989 was just going to be automatic. In fact, there's some things that you have to think your way through and punch your way through.
Right, right. Now, and it's funny because everything you are saying is that the idea of unitary sovereignty is an illusion. And so much that, yes, you can have your nation state, but that nation state is going to have to be part of larger structures for it to survive, for it to survive, for the people in it to flourish. And that means that, and everything about the Trump campaign, it's not just the Trump campaign, it's a certain concept of nationalism, is this idea of radical national sovereignty, that we are totally unconstrained and we will do totally what we want, and we're not going to have multilateral trade agreements, we're not going to have things like the EU, which take sovereignty away from nations and so forth. So that basic structure, that illusion that can even be a viable way forward is what we're confronting. Let me, while we still have our readers, let me just go through a few of your books because I want to recommend them again. The one that we have been discussing mainly is called The Reconstruction of Nations. It was published in 2003, and it is again about the evolution of different concepts of nationalism and evolution of different states in, broadly speaking, Eastern Central Europe, going back three or four centuries. There's also On Tyranny, which is your new book, which is about kind of the current political moment that we are in, and authoritarianism and battling it. There's also Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, which is about multiple overlapping genocides and mass murder in the same region. And finally, Black Earth, The Holocaust is History and Warning, which I believe is just preceded Bloodlands, like chronologically. Am I right about that?
Just the other way around.
Oh, the other way around. Black Earth. There you go. Okay. In any case, I recommend all of them. I particularly recommend, just because it resonated and made me think about a lot of things, Reconstruction of Nations. Timothy Snyder, thank you so much for joining us. I found the book fascinating and this conversation equally so.
It was a real pleasure. I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Josh Marshall Show. Join us again next week for another episode.